Thanks for tuning in today to Nevada Backcountry with Henry Evans and David Catalano. We are not going to waste any time today. We're going to jump right into our bear episode. So nothing gets people on the defensive like a spring bear hunt. So, Henry, what are some of your first thoughts on spring bear hunting? I know a lot of folks really hit the throttle pretty hard when it comes to anything with spring bear hunting.
Yeah, like you said, nothing evokes such a visceral reaction to hunting like bear hunting.
I remember it's spring hunting mainly. I mean, you know, the fall hunts. Yep.
For some reason, bears get people crazy.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. For some reason, the fall thing kind of flies under the radar. But spring bear hunts in particular get people really upset. And I don't know if it's just on their radar more. People are coming out of their winter hibernation, getting out in the woods. They see people out hunting, wonder what they're doing, and up comes the spring bear topic. I'm a conservationist first, a hunter second. So here's where I come down on the spring bear thing, and we'll talk a little bit about some of the opportunities, some of the states that have a spring bear hunt. But bottom line for me is, from a conservationist standpoint, the spring bear hunt is your best opportunity to kill a mature boar. There's a couple reasons for that. First and foremost, boars come out of the dens before sows.
Yeah.
So if you're hunting in that earlier portion, think April, mid-April-ish, if you see a big mature bear out and about looking for food, odds are higher it's going to be a mature boar. Secondly, bears during the spring are going to be easier to pattern. They're not traveling long distances. They're not moving mountain range to mountain range. They're going to food and they're going back somewhere to sleep. So you should get multiple opportunities to get eyes on a bear and make a determination whether or not it is a sow or a boar. You stack the deck in your favor in that instance for killing a mature boar. Now, I want to point out, I've focused on the boar thing, but killing a sow is still legal. It's legal in California. It's legal in Idaho. The only stipulation is you cannot kill a sow with cubs. And as you and I both know, that's all well and good in a perfect world. But there are those instances. In fact, when we were looking up, it was Washington, I believe.
Yes.
145 bears. Now, Washington lost its spring bear hunt in November of last year.
Correct. They did it through a vote. Yeah, they lost it.
Right. So, and we'll cover kind of why that was and how Nevada has been extremely smart in protecting the fall bear hunt. But back to the sow boar issue, Washington, 145 bears killed in their last spring season. Only one was a lactating sow. How that happened, you know, who knows? It's not illegal. But again, from a conservationist standpoint, the goal is to kill a mature boar. I think that's made easier in the spring, and especially in states that still allow hound hunting, because you get the opportunity to really get up close and personal with a bear and make sure what you are killing is a mature boar. What's your take on spring bear season, David?
Well, as long as it's biologically sound, to have that season implemented is really my first and foremost. It's as you stated, conservationist first, hunter second. And I'm fine with a good, solid reason for having the spring hunt if it has biological sound evidence to do so. To your topic of the boar and the sow, you know, sometimes that you can have a sow come in as a hunter, you're watching it going, okay, I'm not seeing anything else. It's a good bear, good size. I'm going to go for it, not knowing that those cubs could be 50 yards, 100 yards down the trail.
And a lot of times they won't bring in cubs, you know, food, water, all those necessities. Those are also danger points. That's where they get ambushed. So a lot of times the cubs won't come in to the food source or to the water source, whatever. Mom will come in, spend an hour making sure she doesn't get ambushed as she's feeding. And you're exactly right. They could be just off trail.
Yeah.
out of sight.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you and I are in agreement on this spring bear thing. Now, somebody posted a comment on the spring bear on Facebook that the spring bear thing intrigued him, asked if this is something that Nevada was considering. We have no idea on that. We're not going to touch that. We are going to focus on Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, Oregon, Utah, Arizona, and Alaska. These are all states where you can do a spring bear hunt. I spend some time in Idaho, and they have, you can run them with hounds, you can bait. They have been very good about making sure they set hunters up for success. And I think you mentioned Oregon is another one.
Yeah, Oregon's another one. A couple years back, the non-resident tag fee was right around $200 for a bear. And with their numbers increasing, they dropped those non-resident fees down to what the resident fees were, just to bring in hunters to have an opportunity to harvest bears. I was up there bow hunting a blacktail a couple years back and came across quite a few bears during my hunt. I was really regretting not having bear
a tag.
There's quite a few. So yeah, they've kind of really incentivized their program to bring in more hunters because of that. And a lot of it's because of the management. The agencies, they've been having these management programs for decades, trying to improve habitats, protect some habitats towards proper populations for wildlife. It's starting to pay off. You're starting to see that in several states. North Carolina is a great example where in the 70s, their bear populations were declining quite quickly. They implemented a management program, and now here we are. They're expanding their hunting opportunities because of their management practices over the last two decades. So when people look at hunts and think, well, they're just doing that just so that they can hunt. No, we're doing that. Agencies are doing that to maintain healthy, strong populations across their landscapes.
And with those sound management practices, it tends to pay off. Is it an overnight payoff? No.
Oh, God, no.
But on a long enough timeline, you look at this stuff and you realize it pays off. And I wanted to give a quick kudos. Well, nothing I do is quick. I'll wander around philosophically for a while before I get to my point. But in Nevada, they've been very smart about how the hunt was implemented and how the NRS code is written. And for anybody that wants to look it up, it's NRS 501.181, Section 4A. You cannot close a hunting season without sufficient biological evidence. So we have protected our fall bear hunt in Nevada, where Washington hosed themselves. They did not support that spring bear hunt with any sort of data. It was a timber damage deal or something?
Yeah, so when they implemented the spring bear hunt, it was based on timber damage from the bears. It was one of the things, was timber damage from the bears that they were ripping the bark off the trees to get to the, you know, the sugary inside, the sap and such. So when they were asked to bring the data forward during the vote, they were unable to do so because they had not collected it. So that was a huge red flag and provided the 5-4 vote to eliminate permanently the spring bear hunt in Washington.
Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break right here, but we will get back into all things spring bear hunting in just a minute on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. As a reminder, if you guys have show topic suggestions, if you have things you want to hear us talk about, send us an email. It's nvbackcountry@evansbroadcast.com, or go ahead, post a comment. Let us know what you think on Facebook. Before we dive in, I want to touch on something. I'll call it the slippery slope argument. I use California trapping as an example of this. California, since I think it started in 89, they started implementing more and more regulations on trapping. Fast forward to, I believe it was 96, it was extremely regulated. Then fast forward again to 98, and it's only in certain circumstances can you trap. As of 2019, the state of California and Governor Newsom have banned trapping outright. An extremely effective management tool, and now it's gone. So the second you let the antis start dictating things, they will take, and eventually we will lose the ability to manage populations. David, go ahead and lay out. There's an argument being made by the antis. They use hunter numbers declining post-hound hunting bans to indicate that there aren't as many bears. Do I understand that correctly?
Yeah, the Humane Society has petitioned the California Fish and Game Commission on a new petition that states climate change and increased wildfire activity is justification to eliminate bear hunting in California, as well as they're stating, a steep and significant decline in bear hunting or in bear numbers due to the decrease in bear harvest success.
So confirmation bias, they're using data that isn't relevant, but they're using it in a way that fits their agenda.
Right. It's like stepping stones, basically. It's stepping stones. So in 2013, hound hunting was eliminated and you can no longer hound hunt in California for bears. Well, obviously, if you take away a process in which to help you harvest an animal, then sometimes it becomes a little bit more difficult to harvest an animal. So, of course, success has a high potential of decreasing. Well, they're using those particular numbers to just pie in the sky, say, oh, that must be because bear numbers are crashing and we now need to protect them because climate change, increased wildfires, and low hunter success numbers. So they're finding ways of continuing new proposals to eliminate the bear hunt in California.
And that's one thing I wanted to bring up. These quota numbers are not just an arbitrary back office. Hey, fellas,
pulling it from a hat.
There's evidence to support these numbers.
I mean, there's a process that all the agencies go through across the country. You know, they've decades and decades and decades of fine-tuning a management process in order to gain the numbers for these particular quotas.
I still want to kind of focus on the spring bear thing because it's an opportunity for guys right now to buy an over-the-counter tag. We've mentioned some of the states, but in Nevada, the fall bear hunt, what is the quota there?
I think it's around 22 bears can be harvested. So 2021, 14 bears were harvested. Six males and seven females, if I recall. And the quota was never achieved. Now, the quota was achieved in one area, 291, for females. So that area was closed. In 2022, 13 bears were harvested, never hit any of the quotas.
Moving back to the spring bear hunt, one of the things I wanted to touch on is everybody focuses on the bear, and yeah, okay, we're hunting bears out there, but I wanted to bring up the reason spring bear hunts are so crucial to overall wildlife management. During that spring bear season, it's the same time of year when you have fawns, mule deer fawns, elk, calves, you have all of this going on. And as you know, spending time out there, fawns, elk, calves, etc., can't escape from a bear. They tend to just bed down wherever and stay. So it does impact that survivability of some of these other species. I think the fall bear season is great, but I do think there is an argument to be made for a more robust spring bear hunt in a lot of states.
Agreed. I would say that it's valid. It's where the biology comes in. That's where the agencies come in and they are monitoring this and gaining that information. you know, to either support the spring hunt, add the spring hunt.
Yeah. Can't throw stuff at the wall and hope something sticks.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what a lot of these other organizations are doing.
And now, hot off the press.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, hot off the press. There was something we said last episode that was incorrect.
Yes.
Or somebody approached you about the first come, first serve tags. This just recently came to pass.
Correct.
What was that?
Yeah, so I was approached by an individual, and the first come, first serve, we spoke about this on one of our previous episodes, where I had stated the first come, first serve tags could be acquired by either residents or non-residents, and it didn't matter the tag that was available, what its designation was. So what I had stated was that a non-resident could buy a resident tag on first come, first serve, and a resident could buy a non-resident tag on first come, first serve. Well, that has been changed. So the new regulation or guidance on the first come, first serve is they are specific to the tag's residency. So if it is a resident mule deer tag, antlered mule deer tag, only a resident of the state can acquire that tag, and vice versa. That was the clarification. That was recently changed back in, I think, just November. I did not have the correct information when we did that episode, but
fantastic news for
Nevada.
Yeah,
that was the only thing we got wrong, so that's still like an A, right?
So, yeah.
It's like 93%.
It's better than I did in high school, but so somebody made a comment or something to the effect of we all know that Endow is really existing to serve out-of-state hunters or California, something like that. So I would chalk this up as a win for hunters in the state of Nevada. You can no longer purchase a first-come, first-serve resident tag as a non-resident.
Right.
I think that's a win.
Well, it's definitely a win. And the one thing is 10% of the total quota for the year is designated for non-residents. And that's been the same for years. It's always been 10%. It's always been 10% of the total quota for that hunting season.
Yeah, so that seems like a pretty fair and balanced number.
Yeah.
I mean, that overwhelmingly looks like it supports Nevadans that hunt.
The Nevada Department of Wildlife has shifted some of the deadlines for applying for tags to allow more non-residents to apply for non-resident tags. Those are not affecting the residents' tags and their opportunity to get tags.
Okay.
So they've changed the dates because some states have their draw results released on a certain day. And once those individuals, you know, either received tags or didn't, so the individuals that did not receive tags, they're like, dang it, man, I didn't get a tag again in such and such state. Well, heck, Nevada's still open. I am now going to take the money I just spent here, and I am going to now put in for Nevada's non-resident antelope or deer or sheep or goat or, you know, whatever in the world they want to. So it provides hunters an opportunity to apply in more states by changing some of those dates. It doesn't matter resident or non-resident.
Right.
But it still, and the thing, does not affect X amount more non-residents applying for tags. That is not affecting the residents having an opportunity to pull resident tags.
I want to highlight that, you know, we thrive on listener feedback or interaction with listeners. So thank you to whoever pointed that out. That's what I want. If we do say something incorrectly, or the data is from 2018 and now as of 2023, it has changed, we try to do the best research possible. We make the phone calls. We do the internet deep dives on stuff. But if we do say something that you know right away, hey, that's not correct, and here's the evidence to back that up, please get in touch with us. Let us know. We'll thank you, and we will correct ourselves in an upcoming episode. Now,
Think we just opened the door on that one for sure, since we just got done talking about bears.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's going to light up.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Stay tuned. Coming up at 11 on 99.1 and 92.3, Tom Gresham's Gun Talk. Thank you guys sincerely for all the messages, all the show topic suggestions. We take all that to heart. Feel free to send us an email and automatically get entered into the contest to win the Reliant Wall Safe NV Backcountry at evansbroadcast.com. We are back on Nevada Backcountry, and we've got a special guest right now. It is Chris Costin from the Muley Fanatic Foundation. Chris is a phenomenal spokesperson for mule deer. It's a great organization. There's a banquet coming up. We will get into all of that in just a second. Chris, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great, Henry. Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. You want to talk to us a little bit about the organization? I know we had kind of briefly spoken about the history of the organization. Take us through a little bit about you, the organization, and stuff you guys work on.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm born and raised in Nevada. Grew up hunting in north and eastern Nevada my whole life. Ran around the hills with my grandpa and dad as soon as I could cock the Daisy Red Rider and get out there with them. So I've been here my whole life, got to hunt in the, you know, late 80s and early 90s and see that real peak of mule deer for my lifetime at least. And, you know, just watching those declines in the herd and the quality of the animals out on the landscape, and then kind of the degradation of the landscape through certain things, wildfire, you know, wild horse populations booming,
feral things, you know, feral kind of horses,
like feral
horses, yeah, feral Chris. Horses, yeah.
Thing. Yeah.
Well, that was my impetus, you know, to start this. I want to see, you know, mule deer and their habitat thrive in Nevada, you know, for my kids and their kids. So I really wanted to do something that was going to give, you know, give back. I wanted to get more involved than just being a hunter. I wanted to be out there conserving our landscape and, you know, what we hold dear in Nevada. So started looking around, checking in different conservation groups, and I settled on MFF because of their funding model. They're a good group because they everything is cut and dry. It's a 70-30 split. So what that does is 70% of our funds, 7 out of every $10 we raise, stays right here in Nevada. It's allocated by Nevadans, our group. They headquarters has nothing to do with it. We send 30% back, which goes to our overall goal, which is preservation of mule deer across the West. And they have 17 chapters in 7 different states, and they are all funded in the same manner. So they all get to use that money in their neighborhoods, in their backyards, while the main chapter works on conservation of mule deer across the West. And those guys, Josh and Joey, started this group. It's 501c3 back in 2012. And since then, just those guys have raised over $2.7 million that they've put back out on the landscape, primarily in Wyoming, Colorado, kind of that their little neck of the woods. But the other chapters, they've raised so much money for mule deer.
I was going to say, plug, it's the Sierra Front chapter, or what's our local chapter here in Reno?
So the Nevada chapter, yeah, Sierra Front chapter.
Okay.
We've been going since 2019. I started it like right before everything went crazy with COVID, so it was a
good timing.
Start to say the least.
Yeah.
A lot of time at home trying to develop a good platform, I guess.
Yeah, I got to do a lot of research, let's say that. And we had everything running. We were building momentum, and then everything got shut down. You know, we lost all our board members. People got sick. People lost their jobs. Pretty rough. So I had to start over in 2020. Just happened to run into Pat Beecham. I was out on an archery antelope hunt up in Paradise. Ran into him. He had a tag up there too. We started talking, and he ended up jumping on the board as my co-chair. And in 2020, we got a virtual banquet off the ground, which was somewhat successful. But then last year, we had our first annual banquet, and we were able to clear and raise over $30,000 that we put back in to a few pretty cool projects here in Northern Nevada that we're pretty proud of.
Do you want to touch on some of those?
Yeah, it'd be kind of cool.
Yeah, I'd love to. So one of the ones that we're always excited about youth hunters and getting more young hunters out there. So we put $1,500 towards a program with Endow that will hopefully allow in the future for some of those kids for us to be able to purchase hunting licenses for them when they go through their hunter safety. So they won't have to go out and buy a hunting license. It'll be given to them for going through the course, and then they can get right out in the field.
Oh, that's cool.
So that's, yeah, we're pretty excited about that. We had another one. I know we've all seen them out in the field, those giant bulky collars that they've been using forever to track the animals, figure out critical winter range, things like that. Now they've got a solar ear tag that's way less invasive, especially on bucks during the rut with, you know, their neck swelling so much. So we put $7,500 towards that. They've got a whole bunch of them out there that they're testing against the traditional collars, and they're out in units 11, 13, 14, and 33. So we're gathering data on critical winter range out there and deer movements.
It's a solar ear tag?
Yeah, it clicks right into the ear. It's solar, so it has, you know, a lot longer field life. It's way less invasive on the animals compared to the old ones. I bet they don't even know it's there.
Right. Have you seen those?
Yeah, I've seen those. And that is satellite-based, correct?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Very cool. The youth thing, so you guys just pick, or do kids apply, or does someone approach the organization and say, hey, I'm putting my kid through a hunter safety program. I want to get them involved. How does someone go about getting involved in that youth tag youth license?
So it's still in the works with Endow. These guys, they're working on it. They're trying to put it together. They're going to propose it to Alan Janae, the new director. They're going to see what they can do to get it going. What we would do is be on the funding side. So
gotcha.
They are going to handle all the kids. They're going to come to us and say, okay, we've got 70 kids going through the program this year. What can we do? And we're going to say, you know, here's the money. Let's get them all licenses and get them out there. You know, the planning, the development and implementation, it will be on Endow's side of it through their hunter education program. We're just going to be there with the money to make sure these kids are getting out there.
So, and that's for kids that are 12 to 16?
I would imagine that would be it. Yeah, you know, when you're getting a little older, we're trying to get younger hunters out there quicker.
So the license program that you've implementing is just for first-time hunters, youth hunters trying to get into the field under the youth tag criteria.
Correct.
Okay, yeah. Cool.
And, you know, to be fair, it's brand new, and, you know, Endow's going to have to come up with that. But that's how I would like to see it structured. That's where I want to be. Those are the kids I want to help get out there.
Oh, for sure, yeah. So. That is awesome. That's a great idea.
I agree. That's why I was like, that is definitely a project we can get behind.
Now, one of the big projects, when you go to the website, you want to plug the website real quick?
Muley Fanatic. That's Muley, fanatic.org. That is our main website. From there, you can link into all of our chapters, all of the big projects that we've been working on out of HQ. And then it'll also highlight some of the larger projects within each chapter's organization. Like our big one was the Dry Valley seeding in Unit 021, where we got 893 acres reseeded. And it was pretty cool. We collaborated with Endow. So our $22,000 turned into $66,000 really fast.
Oh, wow. Very cool.
That is really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, those reseeding projects are just so important after a fire or after any kind of habitat damage. It's critical because there's so many opportunities for invasives to come in. And once those are established, it's an absolute nightmare to remove that stuff.
Cheatgrass, anyone?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I would say that's one of the biggest threats facing our mule deer herds is the loss of that sagebrush ecosystem.
Yeah.
That the critical winter range and then the invasive species coming in and you know, dominating a landscape and in some cases making it, you know, almost impossible to regenerate that lost habitat.
Oh yeah, once it's established, it just does not let anything else germinate. And it loves to burn.
You know, oh, yeah.
It goes into that survival mode, and just those seed pods start popping, and next thing you know, there's three times as thick.
Chris, get into the upcoming banquet. If you want to highlight key sponsors of the event, you got any hunts you're auctioning off? Talk through some of the items you'll be giving away.
Yeah, the banquet is going to be on February 11th. It's at the Reno Elks Club, and doors will open at 4:30. You can get ticket at our website, which is 2023bank.givesmart.com, or you can contact me anytime. But it's going to be a good one this year. We've put together a lot of really good packages. We've had some amazing sponsors. Mastercraft Hardwood jumped in early, Q&D Construction, Western Nevada Supply, Truck NV, just a bunch of good local businesses that have the same focus, have the same drive to make sure that we're keeping the wildlife going and that we're conserving the habitat. We have some really good hunts this year I'm excited about. We got a company down in Argentina to work with us for a dove hunt, and that's pretty much all covered. There's a few expenses where you pay for shells and field guides and things like that, but that's a really exciting hunt. We've got another African safari that we're putting out there. Hey, this is Chris Costin with the Muley Fanatic Foundation, and you are listening to Nevada Backcountry on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk.
I went last year to the inaugural in-person banquet. Absolutely fantastic time. Great venue. It was just a great experience. I had the lucky table last year, not for me. Everybody else sitting at the table, I think, won something. Offline, I know I talked to you this year. I'm cool with the lucky table thing. Just throw me a bone. I wanted to plug, we're going to be running ads here on 99.1. We will be out there. Jerry Evans, my dad, will be there. David and I will be there representing the show, Nevada Backcountry, and I will make sure that on the Nevada Backcountry Facebook page, I'll link the website to get tickets. I'll put the flyer up on there. So if anybody listening wants to know more about the event, where to get tickets, all that stuff, we will cover that on a Facebook post and make sure we get that information out there. David and I were just talking about, I told him, unfortunately, I bring my wife to all these banquets, and I usually wind up with like some silly painting of a kid holding a shotgun and some overalls, when really what I want is the Argentina dove hunt.
You realize you just set yourself up.
I'm going to get my clock cleaned on that one.
And when she goes to the dinner, she is going to look for the weirdest auction.
The flower pot with a muley painting on it.
Exactly. She's going to go, all right, this is yours.
So, Chris, we talked about some of the projects you guys are involved in, talked about the banquet, but I wanted to talk about that migration corridor project. I know that's pretty prominently displayed on the website. I know that's something Muley Fanatic Foundation was integral in.
I know that, you know, in Wyoming, they have one of the largest and longest migrations for mule deer, and their migratory corridors are just immense. Over 20% of the accidents in Wyoming are wildlife related, and they're within, you know, that migration corridor area primarily. And not only do they have mule deer and elk, they've got antelope. They're all kind of using these corridors through these passes. And for Josh and Joey, the founders of it, I mean, that was so key for them, just to see that these overpasses are and underpasses are constructed. And not only that, but funding the collaring projects, helping with the universities to compile all this data and get it established so that they can really pinpoint the key areas. Because for them, I mean, they're having hundreds of thousands of wildlife vehicle incidents every year. Not only loss of human life, but a massive loss of wildlife, going to waste on the roadside. So, I mean, those guys have put just so much time and effort and money, and you get in there and you start reading about everything they've done and how many projects. I mean, that's Wyoming's every chapter there is that's just their key goal. They're raising, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars per chapter and really putting them into those studies and, more importantly, into the construction of it. As an organization, it's so important, and for us too at home, I mean, we see it, and one of our future projects that we're really excited about is we're collaborating with the Nevada chapter of the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, and right. we are going to really start pushing Indow. There's a lot of federal funds floating around right now that can be utilized, and we want to see an overpass put in out in the Cold Springs area, something to give those animals a way across North 395 up there and give them a safer route across the road. You know, we've been looking at it, maybe an underpass, but it seems more, it would do a better job to have an overpass. And if we can raise a considerable amount of funds this year, we're hoping to put half of what we get this year towards that and try and get some fire under these guys with money in kind and see what we can't get going out there. Just like in Wyoming, you know, we have those migration corridors. We have those areas up east. When you drive up there, you can see them all over the place as you're heading out to Weld and right. Jackpot out there and all that. We need it here in northern Nevada. We need to protect those migration corridors where those deer are coming out of California and they're, you know, they're coming up into winter here in Nevada.
I've definitely noticed carcasses on the side of the road when we've been traveling on that northern 395 stretch. It's definitely something that is needing a... That's the only way that they can get from one to the other, because we've cut it off through highway infrastructure and we didn't take that into consideration as a... I'm glad you're doing that.
Now, Chris, to put you on the spot, how many migration corridor projects has PETA funded? Do you know? I recently had an interaction with a vegan, and there was definitely a talking point he was sticking to and not moving off of. So I'll give him credit for being myopically focused, but I want to emphasize that point. As in fact, we talked in a bear segment just a minute ago. I always say I'm a conservationist first. I'm a hunter second. As a conservationist, these kinds of projects are absolutely crucial to sustaining populations, giving them, you know, whether it's the reseeding of burned areas, giving them a food source, putting our money where our mouth is, and funding these migration corridor projects. And oddly enough, I've never seen the vehement anti-hunters out there doing any of this. They're very quick to hop on the keyboard and, you know, stick to their talking points, but they absolutely do not get out there in the field and make these habitat improvements like hunting organizations do.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, it's a lot harder to pick up a shovel and start digging holes for fence posts and preserving springs or, you know, tearing down fence or getting out there and really hitting the streets and talking to folks and raising awareness and bringing in funds and then doing the hard work of sitting down with legislators and really, you know, getting the people who matter to get behind a project and to show them. And, you know, what an amazing state Nevada is. I mean, I think we raise more conservation funds by hunters and sportsmen for conservation than any other state in the nation. Everybody out there, all the other game management organizations, they all want to be like Nevada. I mean, the amount of money that we give back and that we put out there to preserve and conserve our wildlife is just amazing. I'm always humbled by how much and how giving our sportsmen are. It's 100%. It's the hardworking men and women that want to see it happen and put their money where their mouth is.
Very well stated. That was perfect.
All right. Now, Chris, can I put you on the spot with what your choice units are for big mule deer, or do you not want to talk about
that? Let me get the, hold on. I got Latin longs for you.
Perfect.
Right. There you go.
Yeah, no, not Red X, but where do you like to hunt?
It's funny. A lot of people are going to laugh, but one of my favorite places is the Rubies. They're steep, deep, and you can just get lost back there. So I love hunting the Rubies, one, because I love hunting and I can draw it just about every year, if not every other year.
Yep.
And it's gorgeous country, absolutely gorgeous country.
Oh, yeah, it's humbling. I mean, it'll kick your butt in a heartbeat. Yeah. I've been going as far back as I can get the last few years. We pulled out a really nice 4x5 archery buck this August, and, you know, it was typical rubies. August, we had snow, lightning and snow, rain.
That sounds about right That sounds about right for an archery hunt.
10,000 feet of glory. I also love the sixes. Winnemucca area is just gorgeous out there. There's some really beautiful bucks, and you know, everybody knows out east, but you know, I travel. I like to hit just about every western state. When about every 3 years, I'll get lucky somewhere. So yeah.
Well, and the thing is every unit in the state of Nevada has really nice deer in it if you're willing to put some wear and tear on those boots.
100%.
You know, there's a lot of hunters that complain about certain areas. You know, there's no deer. We were out there for 5 days. We saw nothing. And you later find out that they never got off their quad or out of their truck. They're glassing from the pickup truck. And that's unfortunate because they're missing out on a wonderful opportunity to see some incredible country, incredible wildlife, and just really immerse themselves in Nevada's backcountry.
100%. I couldn't agree more. And I think a lot of people, when you hear that, it's like you said, they're not getting out of the side-by-side. They're going to a knob, and they're looking where they think the deer should be. They're not going out and looking for sign. They're not moving through the field, you know, looking for forage, looking for water, looking for tracks, looking for any kind of sign, and then focusing in on areas like that. They tend to want to look where they think deer should be, and that's typically, you know, not where they are.
Yeah, exactly, or where they hope a deer is. Or an animal is, so that they can get it off the mountain without too much pain and agony.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Everyone I get, I drag it right to the truck and throw it in whole. New 6.5 bullets just knock them right into butchered pieces all wrapped in the steel.
Yeah.
Thank you, guys. Yeah, Henry, David, you guys are the best, man. I appreciate it. And, yeah, you guys ever want to talk deer hunting, man, I'm down.
All yeah, right. Very all cool. Right. Very cool. Hey, thank you very much, Chris. Appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you guys so much for your support and your help. And I really enjoyed it. So you guys take care.
Absolutely, right, man. We'll see you Saturday night.